50 acres and a Model A, right in the middle of Trump country. I told you there goes a neighborhood. Now Mr. Williams ain't so funny. I see you looking out your window. Can't wait to call the police on that. When I know you think I'm up to something, I'm just eating, I was still hungry. And this is mine, not legit. I ain't leaving and you can't take it from me. I remember when you used to tell me, nigga run, go back where you come from. Nigga run, go back where you come from. We don't want your kind. We think you's a dog. Fuck you, I'm America's son. This is where I come from. Can't stop crying, then I can't let them break me. No, I can't let them find me. You can meet my friend the governor, only if you wanna try me. Or you can meet my other friend the judge, just in case you think I'm lying. Then I know you think I'm up to something. I'm just eating, I was still hungry. And this is mine, now legit. I ain't leaving and you can't take it from me. I remember when you used to tell me, nigga run, go back where you come from. Nigga run, go back where you come from. We don't want your kind. We think you's a dumb boy. Fuck you, I'm America's son. This is where I come from. This land is mine.
Desolation Angel Radio on the week of January 30th. Polar vortex has gripped Buffalo. And it's not a joke. It is exactly as cold as advertised. It is not okay out there. I mean, it just isn't. Ash and I went out and shoveled today to try and get one car out, and we literally did it in 10 to 15 minute shifts. You got to work it exactly as if it was the middle of a heat wave. Same rules we use in the Gulf for heat. It's wind chill says it's about 25 below. If you know people, and I'm going to say this right up front, if you're in Western New York, if you're in Buffalo, if you know somebody who has no heat, has no power, if you know somebody who is underdressed, who can't afford to turn their furnace up, you get a hold of them and put them in your house, or just get a hold of me and I will put them in this house and we will find a way to keep them warm, because nobody should be out in this. My concern goes out for all the people I met over the course of the Nomad Project, over the holidays, the people in missions and shelters, the homeless people. It is absolutely incredible out there. The grip, and Buffalo doesn't even have the worst of it. Chicago will be colder tomorrow on Thursday. Chicago will be colder than Antarctica or the Arctic. And the way the polar vortex works is normally that the polar ice cap keeps the polar vortex in place up over the North Pole. But as the polar ice cap is warming and melting, the polar vortex splits apart and spreads down. And so what we have is this here across the Midwest and the Great Lakes and the Upper Great Lakes and Western New York, here in America. And in Adelaide, Australia, it's 116 degrees Fahrenheit and it's melting asphalt. Welcome to the age of weather extremes, as things begin to happen faster and faster, because here's the real facts. The ocean is warming four times faster than we thought it would. Arctic and Antarctic ice is melting six times faster than anybody thought it would. And it's destroying the temperature balance in the atmosphere. 2000, despite what you see outside, which is local weather, 2018 will go down on record as the hottest year ever. And 2019 looks to advance that. And we will see exactly what happens. There's some pretty good scenarios that have been put together for projecting out over the next 7 to 10 years as this begins to come to a head and we start to figure out what's going to happen. I was in New Orleans last week working, and then offshore, and then back here in Buffalo this week. Ash was up in Toronto. We figured some things out. The weekend of the first blizzard, we decided to cut a 6x8 foot opening in the front of the house and install the front door. This particular polar vortex winter storm and blizzard, one of the pipes burst under the house, so we decided last night, as temperature was dropping to near below zero, to start working in a sub-zero crawl space. And let's see, the sum total of that was we got water back to the upstairs and then went out today to shovel. And all of a sudden, there's water dripping down from the upstairs into the stripped-out lower floor, which turned out to be the toilet upstairs broke, and the fill valve no longer shuts off, so you have to kind of fiddle with that to use the toilet. You know, use the toilet, manually fill the tank, and shut it back off. All of this with it minus 25 wind chill outside. We're not right the way we choose to do work. But anybody who knows us knows we're not right. If that's an explanation, we're just not right. It was good to be back in New Orleans. It was good to be back on stage with all my friends at Esoterotica. I did a piece last week that I'm really proud of. Things are in a good way. You know, things are in a really good way and moving forward and being exactly what they're supposed to be. My big topic right now, is social media, which I've overused in the last 24 hours because I'm stuck inside. But I've been reading some really revelatory articles about Facebook and why not to use Facebook and why to get rid of it, and a reminder that I have to kind of get it back under control in my life and get it back to my average 17 minutes a week, which really is. I have been known to use it a grand total of 17 minutes a week, and I like it there, since the average user uses it 50 minutes a day, close to 8 hours a week. A great book out called Zucked, Waking Up to Facebook Catastrophe by Roger McNamee, who was an early investor. And I've read that. And I like his statement, "The dystopian technology future overran our lives before we were ready." You think that sounds like an overstatement? Let's examine the evidence. At its peak, the planet's fourth most valuable company, and arguably its most influential, is controlled almost entirely by a young man with the charisma of a geometry TA. The totality of this man's professional life has been running this company, which calls itself a platform. It provides a curious service wherein billions of people fill it with content. Baby photos, birthday wishes, concert promotions, psychotic premonitions of Jewish lizard men. No one is paid by the company for this labor. On the contrary, users are rewarded by being tracked across the web, even when logged out, and consequently strip-mined by a complicated artificial intelligence trained to sort surveilled information into approximately 29,000 predicted data points, which are then made available to advertisers and other third parties, who now know everything that can be known about a person without trepanning his or her skull. Amazing, none of this is secret, despite the company's best efforts to keep it so, and people still use and love the platform. You know, a tech company founded on creating human connection is now ripping American society apart and compromising our civic foundation, though not because it has overtly wicked intent. You know, choices including the platform's pleasurable frictionless interface, which encourages users to stay and return. It's no stretch to posit that because human neurotransmitters respond to the platform's iconic use of a certain shade of blue and spark with dopamine upon receiving a like or tag notification. Not even Orwell, after a feast of psilocybin, could have predicted this dystopia, and this one's all ours. And this guy was an early investor and pulled himself out. He pulled his venture capitalist firm out when he saw where it was headed. And he does call Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg's leadership of it completely amoral. You know? And he also does take the care to, and this is true, and I've said this before, to remind the reader of the telltale heart, or lack thereof, beating beneath the floorboards at Facebook headquarters. Its first iteration, FaceMash, invited Harvard students to compare photos of female classmates for the high cause of determining who was hotter. Yes, the world's fourth most valuable company can trace its origins to the frustrated misogyny of an incel. The moral vacuousness Zuckerberg displayed as a young adult should have told us something about he and many other young disruptors intended to operate. Now, social media has enabled personal views that previously been kept in check by social pressure. So, there was another great one that I read the book on the way. I always read a book. I like the tactile feel of a book, having a book in my hands. Michiko Kakutani, who headed the New York Times book review and was the chief editor there, and 9 essays about the death of truth, but she was talking also about the same subject and traces it back to postmodernism and Derridean deconstructionism. Listen to this one carefully, you know. Parallel with academia's embrace of postmodernism was the blossoming in the 1970s of what Christopher Lash called the culture of narcissism, and what Tom Wolfe memorably termed the Me Decade, a tidal wave of navel-gazing, self-gratification, and attention-craving that these two authors attribute to two very different causes. Lash saw narcissism as a defensive reaction to social change and instability, looking out for number one in a hostile, threatening world. In his 1979 book, The Culture of Narcissism, he argued that a cynical ethic of Self-preservation and psychic survival had come to afflict America, a symptom of a country grappling with defeat in Vietnam, a growing mood of pessimism, a mass media culture centered on celebrity and fame, and centrifugal forces that were shrinking the role families played in the transmission of culture. In contrast to Lash, Tom Wolfe saw the explosion of me in the 1970s in an altogether happier, more hedonistic development, an act of class liberation powered by the post-war economic boom, which had left the working and middle classes with the leisure time and disposable income to pursue the sorts of vain activities once confined to aristocrats, the remaking, remodeling, elevating, and polishing of one's own glorious self. Economic times would grow considerably darker in the 21st century, but the self-absorption that Wolfe and Lash described would remain a lasting virtue of Western life, from the mid-decade of the 1970s on to the selfie age of Kim and Kanye. Social media would further accelerate the ascendance of what Columbia Law School professor Tim Wu described as the preening self and the urge to capture the attention of others with the spectacle of oneself. With this embrace of subjectivity came the diminution of objective truth, the celebration of opinion over knowledge, feelings over facts, development that both reflected and helped foster the rise of Trump. So that's it's interesting thoughts and ones that kind of absorb me because they go they play off of something else. A New York Times article today, there was actually an objective study done that explores and talks about what happens when you finally rid yourself of the social media platform of Facebook. And what happens is very simple. You actually feel better. And let me, before I say that, let me tell you. So there was a study. There's a cadre of psychologists that has argued for years that the use of Facebook and other social media is linked to mental distress, especially in adolescence. Others have likened habitual Facebook use to a mental disorder, comparing it to drug addiction, and even publishing MRI images of what Facebook addiction looks like in the brain. And so a randomized trial that was financed by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, and which is a nonpartisan supporter of research in science, technology, and economics, sketches out a pretty nuanced, balanced portrait of daily use that is not going to likely satisfy supporters of the platform. So the researchers found a target group. We got 3,000 people to sign up, and had half of them deactivate their profile, 1,500 people. So they kept Messenger, but here it is. When the month was over, the quitters and control subjects again filled out extensive surveys that assessed changes in their state of mind, political awareness, and partisan passion, as well as the ebb and flow of their daily activities, online and off, since the experiment began. For abstainers, breaking up with Facebook freed up about an hour a day on average, and more than twice that for the heaviest users. They also reported spending more time offline, including with friends and family. You know, one of the doctors that was directing it actually expected more substitution into Twitter, Snapchat, and online, but it didn't happen. So what it said was, does temper the widely held presumption that habitual social media use causes real psychological distress. So, if heavy... Psychologists and computer scientists have made the case that social media is addictive, and few habitual Facebook users would disagree. And the new experiment provided plenty of supporting evidence. And after it ended, the subjects who had quit for a month said they planned to use Facebook less, and they did so, reducing their previous habit, at least for a while. And I found that to be true for myself as well. When I took a 90-day break from it, my use has been much less. And especially when I refer back to the Kakutani book on The Death of Truth, one of the things that I did find was because a couple of times, and especially when you talk about siloed thinking and tribalism and groups of people, people try other people in absentia. It's really amazing because I've seen that happen. I've had it happen to me a couple times. And I'm cool with it. I'm good with it. But there's another part of it where, you know, I say to myself, well, wait a minute, you know, why in the hell, you know, would anybody want to do what they did? And I get it. I really do. Because it is about tribalism. It is about siloed thinking. It is about group thinking, hive mind. It is about if you don't think as I think, do as I do, or if you don't act as expected, then people are going to lose their minds, especially on social media. Because I've said it before, if you want to know anything about me, you need to talk to me. You can't judge anything by what somebody else says about what I did or what I said, because you don't know context about shit. And it got really interesting because as I'm thinking about all this, I actually ran across an interview that occurred in On Point, an NPR program I listened to, with Shoshana Zuboff, who is professor emeritus of economics at Harvard and studied under B.F. Skinner, the famous behavioral psychologist. And it was amazing to listen to what she had to say. And I'll play the final 10 minutes, the final 10 or 15 minutes of that interview, because it's something you should hear. Again, this is On Point, which is available. You know, the podcast itself is available.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're speaking this hour with Shoshana Zuboff. She's professor emerita at Harvard Business School and author of the new book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, The Fight for a Human Future at the New Frontier of Power. And I just want to play a little bit of tape here from a couple of well-known CEOs from the tech world again, just to get sort of how they see the rise of surveillance capitalism. You heard a little earlier from Eric Schmidt, former Google CEO. Here's another moment from 2010 where Google's chief economist, Hal Varian, suggested that in the future, rather than conducting searches on phones, people would just be able to do searches via an implant in their brains. And a few days later, journalist James Bennett spoke to then Google CEO Eric Schmidt and followed up on that idea.
Is this a realistic prospect in 10 years? And do you understand why it kind of creeps people out a little bit?
There's what I call the creepy line, and the Google policy about a lot of these things is to get right up to the creepy line but not cross it. I would argue that implanting things in your brain is beyond the creepy line.
Mine in particular.
Yes, at least for the moment, until the technology gets better.
That's former Google CEO Eric Schmidt talking about towing right up to the creepy line. Well, another different view can come from, for example, Apple, because it's tried to position itself as a tech company that cares about user data. Here's Apple CEO Tim Cook at a conference on European privacy, or before European privacy commissioners in October.
We shouldn't sugarcoat the consequences. This is surveillance. And these stockpiles of personal data serve only to enrich the companies that collect them. This should make us very uncomfortable. It should unsettle us. We at Apple are in full support of a comprehensive federal privacy law in the United States.
That's Apple CEO Tim Cook, and in a couple of minutes we'll talk about whether or not we're capable of forming the regulatory tools to deal with what Shoshana Zuboff calls surveillance capitalism. But let's go to the phones. Dave is calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Dave, you're on the air. What's your question for today?
Hi. Thank you, Professor. It's amazing what you're bringing to light. I'm going to buy your book today, and I wanted to ask for your comments on the continued and ongoing censorship of people like Jordan Peterson, Ben Shapiro, Dave Rubin, Camille Paglia, and those who have opinions that differ from the narrative, and how that plays into the control that you believe or that you that we may see these corporations or entities trying to exude over the American public. And thank you very much.
Professor Zuboff, well, go ahead. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Dave. Now, were you talking about censorship in the online environment?
I think that's what he was referring to, and the allegation that companies like Facebook and Twitter sort of de-emphasize those voices in the news feeds of millions, if not billions, of people.
Yes. Well, look, the whole news feed as an institution is deeply problematic. And the idea that that there is a private company, this is a corporation. It's not your friendly community service. It is a corporation, and it's a surveillance capitalist corporation. And the idea that we have given essentially Mark Zuckerberg, because he owns control of a great majority of voting shares, and he has been able to develop his company in an environment nearly free of law and regulation that would prohibit him from doing whatever he wants. And so we have essentially given this one young man control over the way in which information flows in the connected social network. This is pretty bizarre when you think about it. And the news feed, early on, they made a choice that they were going to treat everything in the news feed, make it look exactly equal, so that you could have a newspaper there, like there's something called the Denver Journal, I believe it was called, that was a completely fake paper. It didn't exist. And something from that would come through the news feed right after something from NPR or something from the New York Times. So they supplanted journalism, and they did it in a way that responded to their interest in engaging users for as long as possible in ways that would encourage those users to produce as much data as possible. So their metrics for this feed were surveillance capitalist metrics, were their own revenue metrics, not the metrics of what's good for us. What are the different flows of information that are correct for a democratic society? How do we make sure that there's no fake information in these flows, because that undermines the ability of citizens in a democratic society to share a reality? So this censorship problem, Dave, I would say, is part of this larger, extraordinary development of the concentration of power in a company for no reason other than it got there first and it got there unobstructed, and we haven't done anything yet to stop it.
Mm. Well, let's go to Brian, who's calling from Melrose, Massachusetts. Brian, you're on the air.
Right, thanks for taking my call. So it seems like we've had a scaling up of information long before this period that's being called surveillance capitalism. But I want to push back a bit on the free will portion of the discussion and just ask, if we have free will, then what's the worry about the collection of the data?
Huh. Okay, Brian, interesting question. Thank you for your call. Professor Zuboff, what do you think?
Yes, so free will, this is a very fraught subject, certainly, in philosophy and so forth. But let me just kind of, simplify a couple of points here. One is that the idea of free will is that, there's the present moment. And in the present moment, I can imagine a future moment. For example, I spent a really long time writing this book, Brian. Actually, 7 years. I joke about it. 7 years in my pajamas writing this book, long book. And so I imagined a future where this book existed. On any single day, I could have gotten up and walked out of my house, walked out of my study, you know, and sort of gotten back into the stream of life. I chose not to do that because I was choosing the future. I wanted to create the future that only I could see, only I could envision. And when philosophers talk about free will, this is an essential part of it. The idea that we can close the gap between the present moment and what we envision for a future that only we can see. We do that through our commitment to certain courses of action that we will. We literally will action. Now, the thing about this surveillance capitalism using the vast architecture of the digital surround to create this new means of behavioral modification that touches us in all kinds of ways, almost always out of our awareness. What that does is that really intervenes between the present and the future, because that puts its own reinforcers, its own incentives, its own subliminal cues and ways of shaping and hurting us in between my sense of the present and my idea of how I want to project myself into the future. Mm-hmm. That's the idea of stimulus response, that human agency that should come between present and future is displaced by a form of stimulus response. We know that this works. We know it's very effective. Professor B.F. Skinner, who was one of my teachers at Harvard a million years ago, prove this beyond a shadow of a doubt, and many behaviorist scientists since then. So the thing is that when this is happening massively, ubiquitously, using technologies that we must engage with if we want to participate in our lives and in our societies on a daily basis.
That's right.
It's happening out of our awareness. We have no choice, really, because when it's out of our awareness, we are robbed of self-determination. And those decision rights that, you know, really give me a chance to consider what's actually going on here and what is the cost-benefit. So going back to that creepy line, what Eric Schmidt is talking about is the creepy line that you see, because they blew by the creepy line a long time ago. They just do it backstage, so we don't know about it. That's what concerns me, Brian.
Well, Professor Zuboff, we've got about 5 minutes left here, and I cannot let this conversation go on any further without asking you, what should the regulatory response to surveillance capitalism be? Because, I mean, you write about how surveillance capitalism thrives, is dependent upon a certain lawlessness, right, being beyond the reach of regulation. But on the other hand, I think, you know, you talked about the power that Mark Zuckerberg has a few minutes ago. I think he recognizes that perhaps in the future that there is regulation on the horizon. So I just want to play a quick bit of tape for you, because in April, when he was before a joint session of the Senate Judiciary and Commerce Committee, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham asked Zuckerberg about why the government should let Facebook regulate itself. And here's what Mark Zuckerberg said.
Well, Senator, my position is not that there should be no regulation. Okay. I think the internet is increasingly
important. You embrace
important.
Regulation?
I think the real question, as the internet becomes more important in people's lives, is what is the right regulation, not whether there should
but
be or
you as a company welcome regulation?
I think if it's the right regulation, then yes.
If it's the right regulation. But Professor Zuboff, you write in your book about how our conventional conceptions of privacy protections, it's an inadequate framework to deal with surveillance capitalism. So what is the new framework, regulatory framework, we ought to be thinking about in dealing with this?
Well, believe me, you know, privacy is critical, and we have privacy law. We need more. The antitrust issues are critical. We have antitrust laws, and they need to be enforced. But neither of those specifically addresses this unprecedented logic of surveillance capitalism. So my argument has been that, you know, it's like, you can't design a vaccine unless you have a deep and accurate understanding of the enemy disease. And that's the history of every successful vaccine, is how do you actually understand the disease? Then the vaccine gets a lot easier. So in this situation, we need to understand how surveillance capitalism works, which is why I've spent, you know, a chunk of my life trying to figure it out and share it with people. Because, for example, let's say we just broke up Facebook, but didn't drill down into the level of some of these foundational operations that I've been describing. If we break up Facebook, that means maybe we have four smaller surveillance capitalists instead of one big surveillance capitalist. Right. And then we also disrupt the competitive landscape, opening up opportunities for more surveillance capitalists to come in and compete for the behavioral data and the revenues from the futures markets. So obviously that's not enough. We need to understand exactly how it works, how it unilaterally claims our experience, how it takes our experience, how it translates it into data, how it claims the right to translate our data into predictions, how it claims the right to sell those predictions to other people and not to us, how it claims the right to do all of this without our knowledge, and how it claims the right to maintain the conditions that allows it to have all these other rights. Yeah. You know, so that's what Mark is saying. Oh, yeah, regulation, cool. Let's make sure it's the kind of regulation that lets us keep doing what we're doing. Thank you very much.
Said every powerful CEO ever, right?
But said every powerful CEO ever. Going back to the Gilded Age, those guys used to say, we don't need law. We have the law of supply and demand.
We just have a minute and a half left here to go. And I'm very, I mean, the language that you use about these corporations, these surveillance capitalists claiming rights for their own is very stunning. That could be another hour conversation for us. But I must ask you one last question, Professor Zuboff.
Of course.
Where do you draw the line personally in your own life? What technology apps do you use, do you not use? I mean, how do you go about living in this world of surveillance capitalism?
Well, we're in a situation now where basically every device is a supply chain interface for behavioral data. Everything that has the word smart in front of it or personalized is a supply chain interface for behavioral data. So I try to limit my exposure to those interfaces. I don't need them. I've never been on Facebook. I have lots of friends and family, people that I love. I like to see them. I like to hug them. I like to touch them. I like to go visit them. I like them to come visit me. I have a phone and I have an iPhone. I have no apps on my iPhone. You know what? I lived a long time without apps. I don't find any difficulty at all in living a bit longer without apps. You know, I understand why people need them. People need them because we are harried, we are frustrated, we are stressed, we are pressured. Everybody's working, nobody has time. So we turn to these apps for succor and support. But indeed, the price we pay, as we've been discussing, is just too darn high. I'm not willing to pay it.
Well, Shoshana Zuboff is Professor Emerita at Harvard Business School. Her new book is The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, The Fight for a Human Future at the New Frontier of Power. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Professor Zuboff, this has been an incredible, remarkable conversation. Thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Meghna. I just love talking with you. You're fantastic. Thank you.
And listeners, thank you for joining us as well. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
to me. You can bring a bullet, bring a sword, bring a morgue, but you can't bring the truth to me. Fuck you and all your expectations. I don't even want your congratulations. I recognize your false confidence and calculated promises all in your conversations. I hate people that feel entitled. Look at me crazy cause I ain't invite you. Oh, you important, you the moral to the story. You endorsing motherfucker, I don't even like you. Corrupt a man's heart with a gift. That's how you find out who you're dealing with. A small percentage you I'm building with. I want the credit if I'm losing or I'm winning. On my mama, that's the realest shit.
Let's talk about love.
But then you came, it soon departed. keeps lifting me. Keeps on lifting me.
Keep on lifting,
lifting me. Higher and higher.
Because I see your love.
Your love keeps lifting me.
Keep on lifting.
Keeps on lifting me.
Keep on lifting,
lifting me. Higher and higher.
Higher and higher.
I see your love.
Your love keeps lifting me.
I wrote my way.
When the world turned its back on me, I was up against the wall. I had no foundation, no friends or no family to catch my fall. Running on empty, with nothing left in me but doubt. I picked up a pen and I wrote my way.
I picked up the pen like Hamilton, street analyst. Now I write words to try to channel them. No political power, just lyrical power. Sitting on a crate on the corner, sipping for hours. Scheming on a come up from evening to sun up. My man awaiting trial. Misdemeanors were younger. Courtroom prejudice, insufficient evidence. Jailhouse lawyers, these images still relevant. Flickering light inside my project hall. Sickening, the mice crawl all night long. And 87 Reaganism, many pages I've written on. Writing songs about rights and wrongs and Bell's bonds. Master bedroom, bigger than the crib that I was raised at. I'm the architect, like I wrote the code, the Waze app. I'm driven. Black Elohim from the streets of Queens. The definition of what it was written means. Know what I mean?
I wrote my way.
When the world turned its back on me, I was up against the wall. I had no foundation, no friends and no family to catch my fall. Running on empty, there was nothing left in me but doubt. I picked up a pen and I wrote my way out.
I really wrote my way up out of 6E. Developed relationships with fiends, I know they miss me. Before the Metro cars, it was tokens, I did the 10 speed. Never had wrote a rhyme in my life, what was a 16? At 16, arrested in housing, trip to the mountains, came right back. Trapping off couches, watching for mouses. Only tools we was pros with, had a spot smoke lit. The haters just confusion, pay attention how them jokes switch. Deodora was my favorite, the Marco Cannons, mama couldn't afford them. I learned everything on the border, that's a big eight. Kiko parties with private dancers with no mixtape. Bumblebee tuna, now we could get steak. I persevered, composition, I kept it close, competition near. I'm a Spartan without the spear. 300 rhymes, it was written before I wrote it. Opportunity knocking, might miss it, that window closing. This poetry in motion, I'm a poet.
When the world turned its back on me, I was up against the wall. I had no foundation, no friends or no family to catch my fall. Running on empty, there was nothing left in me but doubt. I picked up a pen and I wrote my way out.
High speed dubbing these rhymes in my dual cassette deck. Running out of time like I'm Jonathan Lawson's rent check. My mind is where the wild things are, Maurice Sendak. In withdrawal, I want it all, please give me that pen back. Y'all, I caught my first beating from the other kids when I was caught reading. Oh, you think you smart, but start bleeding. The pops tried in vain to get me to fight back. Sister tapped my brain, said, psh, you'll get him right back. Oversensitive, defenseless, I made sense of it. A pencil in the lengths to which I'd go to learn my strengths and knock them senseless. These sentences are endless, so what if they leave me friendless?
Damn, you got no chill.
Fucking right, I'm relentless. I know what well I was never really gonna win the lottery, so it's up to me to draw blood with this pen, hit an artery. This Puerto Rican's brains are leaking through the speakers, and if he can be the shining beacon, the side of the GW being shining light when it's gray out.
I wrote my way.
Oh, I was born in the eye of the storm. No loving arms to keep me warm. This hurricane in my brain is the burden I bear. I can do without.
Hamilton.
I wrote my way out of the back. I wrote my way out of the back.
Picked up the pen like Hamilton.
Really, I saw like a hole in the rap game. So if I wanted to put my little two cents in the game, then it would be from a different perspective. I thought that I would represent for my neighborhood and tell their story, be their voice in a way that nobody has done it. Tell the real story.
So there you have it, the Polar Vortex Desolation Angel Radio Show, an Angel's Wanderings podcast. I'm not joking about the cold. It's deadly out there. Frostbite in 5 minutes, hypothermia in probably 10, death soon after. If you see a homeless person, yell, man. Get him in your car, do something, and get him to a shelter. Same for an animal wandering around, a dog, a cat. Check on your neighbors, check on your friends. That's really what social media and text messaging is for, not the various throwings out of political opinions, but to connect and to make sure that everybody's okay and everybody's alive and everybody's making it through. If you're in the Buffalo area, this house has two furnaces, propane torpedo heaters, electric heaters. We've got running water, got food here. So if you get in trouble, you yell or you get your ass here, and you'll have somewhere warm and safe where people care about you, and you'll be all right. And if you see somebody in that position and you can't get to them, you yell and let me know, because we will. It is just incredibly cold, and life really is a live together or die alone proposition. We are all we got. So somewhere out there in the night, I got your back.
Faces, they were all like strangers to me. everybody goes it alone. You know, the flag flying over the courthouse means certain things are set in stone. Who we are, what we'll do, and what we want. It's gonna be a long walk. Hey, pretty darling, don't wait for me. Gonna be a long walk. Hey, pretty darling, don't wait for me. Gonna be a long walk. Gonna be a long walk. It's gonna be a long walk.
As we're vocal.